United States versus James. Ms. Friedman.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Renee Friedman. I represent defendant appellate Jarrett James today. I'd like to just address a preliminary matter before I begin my argument. You know from the docket in this case that Mr. James originally filed a pro se appeal. In my opening brief, I identified certain arguments that Mr. James sought to have raised that he didn't want to have waived, and I indicated that I thought an Anders analysis was appropriate. Mr. James has also requested that, in connection with the briefing of the reply, that he wanted to present an argument that all federal warrants in this case were invalid because they had been executed by municipal law enforcement officers and not federal law enforcement agents. I didn't pursue these arguments in the reply or submit supplemental briefing to you, given the procedural posture of the appeal and this Court's guidance that some challenges, like ineffective assistance of counsel, should be saved for collateral review if the necessary factual record has not been developed. However, for the record, I do want to make clear that Mr. James does not intend to waive this argument or any of the other arguments that have been identified in the opening brief. Now, I know you have the briefs and you have every scrap of testimony and evidence that was offered at the suppression hearing in our supplemental appendix. I don't intend to reiterate those. What I would like to do, however, is focus on what I see as the major theme in this appeal. There is a painting over at the Art Institute, Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. I think most of us, it's an iconic American image, right? The three people sitting at the diner at night, the glass diner. That painting has been, there have been a million homages to that painting, and one of them is actually by Gottfried Helwin, and it's called Boulevard of Broken Dreams. And at that diner, Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, Humphrey Bogart, and Elvis Presley are sitting around the diner. That painting is about sadness and regret, lives cut short, paths not taken, and promises not fulfilled. Every strategic decision we make in a trial, every theory that we pursue at trial, and every theory that we don't, all the evidence that we introduce, and the evidence that we choose not to introduce, all of those have the potential to lead down a boulevard of broken dreams. You might have won if you had chosen a different course, if you had put in more evidence, if you had let that witness talk for another 10 minutes. But the reality is, even though we see the potential after the fact, we recognize that some things just don't reach fruition. And if we hold parties to their burden of proof and establishing things at trial or within a suppression hearing, as the case may be here, we recognize that you have to be bound by the strategic consequences of your decisions. Jarrett James challenged the introduction of a safe and evidence derived from that safe that had been obtained in a warrantless seizure at his mother's home while he was being held in custody. The government elected to defend the seizure on three theories, and they chose what evidence to use to defend the search. The government first argued that Mr. Jarrett James had no possessory interest, he had no property right in the safe that had been infringed by the government's warrantless seizure because he was not present at the home when the seizure occurred. Namely, he was in jail in another state awaiting trial. In our opening brief, we focused a lot of attention on this argument, and this is where the whole Segura argument came into play. In our opening and reply briefs, we focused on the analysis in Soledal that says both property and privacy are protected under the Fourth Amendment. There really isn't any argument about that in the government's brief. The only reply that the government gives us to that is simply to reiterate their briefs from below and say because Mr. Jarrett James was not present at the time of the seizure, it's questionable whether he had any possessory interest in the safe. I think the cases that we cite, including Soledal, make clear that Mr. James does have a protectable property interest, both under the law of tort and also the law of property, and you aren't dispossessed of your interest in property simply by stepping away. It would be the same thing as saying that the police could come in and take my purse out of my office over the lunch hour because I'm not there. I don't abandon my property interest in my purse simply by stepping away for an hour or a day or going on vacation for a month. Now, as to the Segura argument, because the government really doesn't take issue with this, I'm only going to touch on a few basic points. I would reiterate the fact that the portions of Segura that the magistrate judge and the district judge relied upon are not controlling precedent. Those are in Part 4 of the court's opinion. Only two justices joined in that particular portion of the opinion. Segura doesn't say that someone has a limited property interest when they're in custody and they're away from the premises. Segura is just an independent source case, and that's what the Supreme Court held, that all of the evidence was derived from an independent source because the police got a warrant based on probable cause that had nothing to do with the illegal entry and the illegal seizure. So Segura does not support the government's proposition that property interests have been waived. The second point on Segura is this. It may be that in the district court, the government was trying to sort of lay the groundwork for a new theory to be adopted by this court. And it may be that the magistrate judge thought that that was a good theory, too. If this court is interested in exploring that whole issue of whether or not possessory interests or property interests are waived by virtue of the defendant's absence, I would say this would not be the case that you would want to do that in. And it's simply because the way that the government has articulated the Segura issue, namely that a defendant's absence from the premises voids whatever interest he has in the papers and effects, cannot be squared with Soldal. It just can't.
Now, this whole thing started because Mrs. James found out from the son, because he told her the gun was in the safe, and she said she wasn't going to touch it until the police came over and removed it, and then had her lawyer there who said that basically the same thing. And she had the safe in her possession. Doesn't this mean that she consented to the seizure when she gave it to the police, and didn't she have a right to, like, throw the safe away if she wanted? Or
Judge Williams, I think the consent issue is a crucial one here, right? I think I've shown that there was a seizure without a warrant, and there was an invasion of his property rights. So then you ask the question, as you have, has the government proven by preponderance of evidence that you have an exception, right, to the warrant requirement and consent? A valid third-party consent is certainly one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement. So then we ask the question, well, does mom have actual authority to consent to the seizure of the case? As far as I can tell, the question of whether or not a third party has authority to consent to a seizure as opposed to a search, right? I think that is a question of first impression, or at least this court has not clearly articulated whether a third-party consent is okay for a seizure. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. We haven't argued that it is not. So then the question is, well, how do you evaluate whether mom had authority to consent to the seizure? In my brief, I've said you use the test from Matlock, right? You ask whether or not the individual who is purporting to consent has control and use and dominion over the property for most purposes. The government hasn't disputed that that's the right test to use. They've said my cases that talk about third-party consent in search cases don't apply in the seizure context, but they don't say why. And they also don't offer you an alternative test. So I think you use this Matlock test, and you look at the evidence of the record, and you say, does the evidence of record evidence that mom had joint use, control, and authority over the safe and its contents? And the evidence is crystal clear. You have every piece of testimony. The mother did not own the safe. The police knew she didn't own the safe. The mother didn't use the safe. As far as we know, the mother had never even opened the safe. She had it in a closet. It was locked. She clearly wasn't accessing it on a day-to-day basis. It was out of the way. It was only being held for safekeeping for her son while he was in prison. Every factual indicia that could suggest joint use and joint dominion is absent from the record. The only thing that the government gives you in its brief is the fact that mom owned the house.
Mom sold the house, would she be obliged to take that, or would it be abandoned?
Well, Soldal, I think, actually answers that question. When they talk about why you still need a warrant to seize property, right, seize a trailer house in that case, they say that a warrant is still required even if an individual defendant's property is out in the middle of the street and the police drive by. They still need a warrant to take that property unless the property is clearly contraband. Now, the police may think this safe contains contraband, but it's not plainly contraband. So mom could have taken the safe, hypothetically, and put it on the porch because she didn't want it in her house, and it scared her, and she was afraid that the police were going to take her in for obstruction.
If she moved and didn't take it, she didn't abandon it. Is that right?
Well,
you would say she didn't possess it?
The defendant did not abandon the property. The factual question as to whether or not he took a risk of her abandoning it, I don't know, because then you get into situations where people have a reasonable expectation that they will continue to have their property interest. Say you take things to a storage facility and the storage facility goes bust, you usually can recover your stuff even if the person who's your bailor tries to abandon it. So I would say that would be the answer here.
Ms. Friedman, maybe we ought to spend a moment on harmless.
Harmless error?
Yeah.
In the government's closing argument, they had 6 points. They said 6 things prove that this defendant is guilty. 4 of them were focused on evidence that was either from the safe or derived from evidence of the safe. Am I saying that there's absolutely no way this guy could have been convicted?
Let me just go over a couple of things I think that are apart from the safe. And
okay.
Can you tell me if you think that's not the case, all right?
Absolutely.
All right. The first is the testimony of the victim tellers describing the defendant's physical characteristics. Clearly not from the safe, right?
Not from the safe, but he had a mask. Not very strong evidence.
Okay. Evidence describing the vehicle near the bank at approximate times of both bank robberies and evidence that the defendant had stopped a few days after the April 14th robbery, driving a vehicle matching that description with the distinctive wheel covers.
The testimony that they saw a vehicle that looked like that. No, Your Honor.
Okay. That didn't come from. Okay. The evidence that the tires on the defendant's vehicle matched the tire marks left in the snow by the vehicle at the bank, near the bank.
That evidence would not have come into the case, Your Honor, if the safe had been suppressed. Because they didn't find the Mercury Marquis until they looked at papers in the safe that led them to the location of the car, and they would have never been able to do the tire track evidence.
Well, there wasn't any description of the car by the...
Well, the car was described, but the police didn't have the car. So they couldn't connect up the car with...
The pink fleece glove?
That would have been found regardless.
That he was positively identified driving the vehicle after the 14th robbery and possibly tossing the pink glove in the dumpster.
Was he identified by the witness as being the person tossing the glove in the dumpster? Yes. Yes, he was.
And evidence that his DNA was a component of the DNA identified inside the glove?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then do we have evidence from the... his arrest in 06, May of 06, that he was driving a Lexus registered to the state of Wisconsin, registered him in the state of Wisconsin.
That was not direct. Well, stuff relating to the Lexus came from the safe, but that particular thing did not.
Right. What about the evidence that the handgun used in the April 14th robbery was recovered during the Nebraska arrest?
That would have come in. Not the first gun, but the second gun.
That's right. And finally... What about his admissions to the inmate in the jail when he was in custody in Nebraska?
That evidence would not have come out. That evidence didn't relate
to the safe.
To the safe, correct.
Would you say that's a significant amount of evidence for you to challenge the harmless error analysis?
Well, I think it cuts both ways. I don't think that evidence is enough to say beyond a reasonable doubt the jury would have concluded. I think the jury could have still concluded maybe without that first gun that he wasn't responsible, you know, either for the weapons count or the first robbery because there just wasn't enough tying him to the first robbery. So maybe you say it's a slam dunk on number 2, but a reasonable jury could conclude, especially since they deliberated for 8 hours and this was only a 2-day trial, they had some doubt. They clearly had some doubt, and it took them a long time to resolve it. I guess the second side of that coin is that if this is such an overwhelming case, then if you reverse and remand, the government's not going to have that hard of a time doing its work, so we don't have to worry about, you know, the guilty guy going free, which is always what I hear, you know, sort of in the next round of arguments.
I've been on the court a while, and that's I compliment you on a pushback argument on harmless error that... they'll win again if they have the opportunity. So,
you know.
No, I mean that admiringly. I'm not being critical in any.
No, that's fair. That's fair. So I guess we talked about the first exception with Judge Williams as to consent. I don't think the record shows actual consent. You know, the sort of not actual consent, actual authority, and the question of apparent authority, whether a reasonable officer could differ. Or could actually believe based on something that she had said that there was authority. I would just point you to the testimony that's in the record where the officer said he had no idea. I do not know whether she had any interest in the safe.
All right. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Ms. Bowdell.
Good morning. I'm John Vaudry. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney for Madison. I'm the person who made all those decisions at the district court, both at the suppression hearing and at the trial. I want to boil our argument down, hopefully clearly and succinctly. We are not contending that he didn't have a possessory interest in the safe. At page 18 of the brief, I regret to, if I've mused on this in writing, if I mused on it, if Magistrate Judge Crocker mused on it. For this purposes, as I said at the brief, let's assume Mr. James had a possessory interest. He was gone for 6 months. That argument may come, but not today. As set out in counsel's reply brief, the issue simply is, did Mrs. Martin, the defendant's mother, did Mrs. Martin have either actual or apparent authority to consent to us seizing the safe, and did she in fact consent to that seizure? Let me just briefly hit our points and address some of the points raised in argument. My contention or my dismissive part of my brief when I write about the case you see cites goes to this point. I believe a person can have authority to consent to you seizing an item. You've left your suitcase with them. You've said, hang on to it for 6 months. You've left your safe. But I think there's a difference between having the authority to necessarily consent to it being open. Frankly, in this case, I think, given that she had the keypad code, that she probably had authority to search it, to let us search it as well. But the Detective Zimmerman and at that point decided not to do it that way, and that was much more cautious, of course. In terms of her apparent authority, it's her house. She has complete control over the premises. She has complete control over the contents. She had the keypad code to the safe. Now, the argument is made, well, she didn't turn that over until after the seizure. It's a little unclear when she actually said it, but it is clear from the testimony that she gave it to Detective Zimmerman before they walked out the door. And so at the very least, whether it's, I'm going to put my hands in this safe now, she says, well, here's the code, or he's got his hands on the safe, and she goes, here's the code. Everything he knew before he walked out that door would have said to any reasonable law enforcement officer, this person's got authority to let me do this. Whether she opened it or not, I think Ms. Friedman said, you know, maybe she never opened it. I don't have any idea. There's no testimony one way or the other. We know she had the keypad. We know it was in the keypad code. We know it was in her house. I think that as I said, as to the authority, I think it's clear. As to the consent, if it's possible, it's even more clear. She, and in the reply brief, and I just want to address this, the point was made that we were relying on Detective Zimmerman's words and not on the words of either, there aren't any, no testimony from Mrs. Martin, but the testimony from attorney Terry Frederick. What I'm relying on in many parts are Detective Zimmerman's testimony about what they said to him. It's not just his words, but it is his words as a second part. It is his words when he makes a statement and they either don't object or they explicitly or implicitly agree. And the key thing is just really on two of these dates. On October 30, Mrs. Martin calls him back, leaves the voicemail, and he testifies, I quote, she said she wasn't going to touch the gun and would leave it until the police came over. A clear invitation, it would seem, to come over and get this thing. He talks to her the same day, and he says to her, I would like to come over and assist you, in turning the gun over to the police. Now, those are his words. But his testimony is she doesn't say no object. She doesn't object. She doesn't say, what the heck are you talking about? Not surprisingly, because she had essentially invited him by her voice message. Then she hires Attorney Frederick. And on the 1st of November, when Detective Zimmerman calls Attorney Frederick says he wants to make arrangements to turn the gun over to the police. That's Detective Zimmerman's testimony. Now, did Attorney Frederick remember that at the suppression hearing? He could, not surprisingly, he's not doing the investigation. He doesn't remember the dates. He doesn't remember exactly what was said. And I'm not for a minute saying he was dancing or playing a game. It's just his job was to go over there and hold Mrs. Martin's hand. He held her hand, and then he went on about his business, and it was 2 years later. But Detective Zimmerman testified to a clear second invitation. The attorney Mrs. Martin had retained said he wants to make arrangements to turn the gun over to the police. With those two invitations, not surprisingly, when Detective Zimmerman gets there, she shows him the safe. He says, I'm going to take it and get a search warrant. No problem. Nobody says anything. They don't object. And he sees it, and he gets a warrant. And there's at least some, the tone of the reply brief is, well, we have this citizen who's somewhat being put upon by the police, and what she essentially did was just, you know, obey this this police authority. But I think the facts here are clearly different. This is not a meek citizen who didn't know what to do. She's interviewed by the police, as submitted in the appendix. That first interview in October, she dances around a little bit. She's caught between a rock and a hard place. She figures, I think, that Jared James has done something. She doesn't know what to do. And they tell her, as I'm sure every police officer would, look, don't lie to us. This is an obstruction. She then doesn't have to do anything, but she calls them back. She hires a lawyer. And then when the safe is seized, she's got her hired attorney there, and it's taken. It is not some meek citizen being overcome by Detective Zimmerman. I would like to briefly address harmless error. As well as you, Judge Flom, I found the argument interesting that I would say it was such a great case, so why aren't I saying, hey, let's tee it up and do it again?
Had you confronted that argument?
No, I hadn't. And many of my colleagues contend that when I do retrials, that my cases are annuities, and I just like trying them again. There is some truth to that, I suspect. But in this case, just a couple of things I want to address. Your recitation of the evidence we had is exactly accurate. It was a robust case. Did I like the evidence from the safe? You bet. It was, man, when I could get up in closing argument and say, what do you think he was doing at American TV? I mean, that was good stuff, and I enjoyed it. But if I take all that away, I've still got a tribal case. I've got a case that this jury would find, I think, very, very robust. As to the first count, we wouldn't have the gun, but I've tried untold number of bank robberies where there's all sorts of testimony about a gun. There's a gun stuck in your face. There's a gun stuck in your back. They describe the gun, and we don't get the gun. Juries, it doesn't matter. One thing about the tire matches, and I would disagree with counsel, we would have had those tire matches. What happened is, on April 16, we get the description of this either Grand Marquis or Crown Vic, turns out to be a Grand Marquis. And on the 14th of April, we get the same description. Detective from Middleton does a drawing of these things. It's one of the government exhibits. I can't remember what number. It immediately goes out to the police officers. And in one of those occasions when really good cop work helps, 2 days after that second robbery, a Madison officer is driving around. He thinks he sees the car with those wheel covers, a big black marquee. And he follows Jared James into the driveway of the address of his mother, where we ultimately seize the safe. At that point, he talks to Jared James. He's identified with his driver's license. We know this car. Now, can we find the car? That's another problem. But we don't necessarily find it because of anything other than just keep looking around, and we put it all together, and we find it essentially abandoned at a parking ramp. He was positively identified by the citizen who saw him throwing the 2 days afterwards, on the 16th, throws a pink item into the dumpster. A very attentive citizen, a very attentive police officer who was willing to actually go in the dumpster and fish this thing out and not just ignore the call. And in court, he said, that's the man. He describes the Grand Marquis, describes this big black car. So 2 days after the robbery, we have that. All of that is apart from the safe. So I do think if there's any feeling of error here, and I really submit there isn't, it is harmless. It is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We would try the case again. I don't want to try it again. I've got other things to do, but we would try it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fodery. Ms. Freeman, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute. We asked a few questions.
The tire track evidence, I would redirect you to the testimony that we identified in the opening briefs. The car was found not just because the police were wandering around and found it on a ramp. It was found in the parking lot of the apartment that Jared James resided in, the one that I talk about in the opening brief. And the only reason they found that is because they got the lease for the apartment. Then they went to check it out, and it's like, aha, here's the car. There is actually no indication that they would have found that without the evidence derived from the safe. I would note, for whatever purpose is necessary, that the inevitable discovery argument, they only devote 7 lines to that in their brief. It's not anything that they emphasize in oral argument. I think we've explained why the evidence in the suppression hearing is not sufficient to show inevitable discovery. Overall, it isn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. A reasonable jury could have concluded that Jared James was not guilty on all 4 counts of the indictment. As such, we would urge that you vacate the judgment of conviction and the sentence and remand for further proceedings consistent with this court's opinion. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Friedman,
yes,
thank
sir.
You. Mr. Vodery, thank you. As always, Ms. Friedman, I'd like to extend on behalf of the court an additional thanks for your accepting this appointment and so ably representing Mr. James. All right, case is taken under advisement.